We not only saved the world, saved the banks.
Gales of laughter there from MPs as Gordon Brown announced that he is the saviour of the world. Hello, I'm Nick Watt, and welcome to Politics Weekly. We'll be asking whether the Prime Minister's remarks were a slip of the tongue or whether he really does believe he is saving the world. We'll also ask where the recession leaves the pre-election battle between the main parties after David Cameron confirmed that the Tories will cut public spending faster than Labour. We will turn our sights across the Atlantic and ask whether Barack Obama will be damaged by the disclosure that the governor of Illinois allegedly sought to flog off his vacant Senate seat. And finally, we'll discuss our favourite Oliver Postgate characters after the death this week of the creator and narrator of Bagpuss the Clangers and Ivor the Engine. Postgate was something of a serious political blogger. Joining me to discuss these matters is The Guardian leader writer Tom Clark. Hello, Tom.
Hi there.
We have Andrew Sparrow, The Guardian's senior political correspondent. Hello, Andy.
Hi, Nick.
And finally, we have Allegra Stratton, The Guardian's political correspondent. Hello, Allegra.
Hello.
Well, MPs fell out laughing on Wednesday when Gordon Brown slipped up at Prime Minister's questions. Simon Hoggart, The Guardian's parliamentary sketchwriter, describes the scenes for us.
Simon Hoggart, parliamentary correspondent of The Guardian, reporting from Prime Minister's Question Time. Well, it's so weird these days. And now and again, MPs try to bring up the subject of the recession, the fact that businesses can't get credit, the fact that they're having to lay people off, the fact that the recession is galloping along and seemingly getting worse every single day. But of course, all that matters in Parliament is the political battle, which party is up, which party leader is outsmarting the other one. Well, it was a very bad day, I thought, for Gordon Brown, and it started because he was asked by David Cameron what was needed to get business going again. He said that the recapitalisation might have saved the banks, but it certainly hadn't worked in the sense that the banks weren't lending money. Brown said, well, otherwise some banks would have collapsed.
And we not only saved the world, saved the banks, I'm saying.
We not only saved the world, he said. Well, of course, they just went potty when they heard that. The whole place erupted, particularly the Conservatives. They were shouting and yelling and laughing. They went red in the face. They were rolling around. They absolutely adored it. You know, David Cameron kept going on and on and on, the Prime Minister saying that the system wasn't working. It was all very indecisive indeed, and Mr. Brown seemed to be boxed into a corner in a sense, because things are going very badly and he can't deny that. On the other hand, he can only repeat over and over again what they are doing, which doesn't seem to be working. So Cameron finished by saying,
he's brought this country to the brink of bankruptcy and the deepest recession of the G7, and isn't the person responsible him?
He said, dramatically pointing at the Prime Minister. Help was at hand, however. Alan Simpson, normally thought of as a pretty left-wing rebel, was the next Labour member to be called, and he said,
actually, Mr. Speaker, it's quite nice to have a Prime Minister who would save the world when we're faced with an opposition that can barely save face.
Well, the Labour people, immensely relieved by that, they thought that the poor Mr. Brown's wretched mistake had been capped. They shouted, more, more to Mr. Simpson, not a cry he is very familiar with. But just when things seemed to be calming down for a moment,
Nick Clegg
stood up, the Liberal Democrat leader, and you've got to remember that he boasted in a magazine article a little while ago that he reckoned he had had sex with 30 or more women in his time. This is one of those figures that are stuck in people's minds. So when he began dramatically and sternly, recently, a single mum with two small children came to see me in Sheffield, when he didn't get to the end of the sentence, because the gale of laughter that overcame the place simply buried him. In the House of Commons, basically, it's like a bullfight, if you like, or a sumo wrestling or a gladiatorial fight. It has no relevance to what's going on in the world outside, but every single detail is scored against you, and if you start off badly, like Mr. Clegg did, and indeed the Prime Minister did, then you've had it.
That was Simon Hoggart. Poor old Nick Clegg, he was always very shy when he lived in Brussels, I was told. And the reason why that 30 figure came up, I think, was because Piers Morgan in that GQ interview goaded him in an unfair way. Anyway, there we are. We love Nick Clegg. Allegra, I'm going to turn to you first because you live in the House of Commons. tell me about Gordon Brown's slip up. Was it just a mistake, or did it reveal some great inner thought that indeed I, Gordon Brown, am saving
There's
the world?
There's just no way he thinks he saved the world. I know that that's how we write it up. I think he recovered okay I mean, firstly, it's quite interesting. Alan Simpson, that backbencher that stood up to defend him and actually didn't do a bad job of defending him, is no fan of Gordon Brown's. And so it's sort of a little interesting insight into how he sort of has at least got some members of the backbenches off his case, as they were on his case about 6 months ago. But he did recover. Simon talked over the bit of his recovery. He did say, once all the guffawing had died down, he did say, save the world's banks. Now, the way he originally said save the world, it didn't sound like there was an apostrophe S at the end of it. So I think it was a slip. I think he sort of lost his ground. He saw the Tories fall apart, and then I think he recovered with save the world's banks. And I have to say that the way that Cameron used the slip, I thought was too detailed. He made a substantive point, whereas I think he could have made a kind of sort of just kind of let Brown fall apart, and it would have been better theatre.
Tom, you were falling about during Simon Hoggart's piece there. Do you think that Brown recovered? I mean, a lot of people were saying that if it had been Blair, he would have made a joke about it. He would have made a joke against himself, whereas with Brown, it was a bit sort of steamrollery bureaucratic when he came back. What did you think?
Well, I thought that he... First of all, you know, there is a risk that some of this stuff has gone to his head. He's had, like, Nobel Prize winning economist Paul Krugman saying Gordon Brown has saved the world. And so he must have at least had that thought. And so there is, as Simon Hoggart's also written this morning in The Guardian, there's the potential of it being a Freudian slip. But I tend to agree with Allegra. I tend to think it's a straight slip. And I think it's one that made him look a bit silly in the House of Commons. But outside, people might not care. But what I would say is that I think it provides the Conservatives with a wonderful poster. Mm. You can see this for next spring, if we do have an election next spring, which is once again being talked about now. Here's the man who saved the world, they'll be saying, while unemployment's going from 1.5 million to 2 million and maybe 2.5 million. And anything that makes it look like you think you've sorted out a problem that's getting worse isn't going to be good politics.
Andy, let me just ask you, the reason why we had those exchanges in Parliament on Wednesday is because the Tories were making a really serious point that the bank recapitalisation plan, which Paul Krugman praised, which made Gordon Brown supposedly the saviour of the world, the Conservatives, David Cameron, saying that's not working, banks are not lending, and they're making a really serious point there. Is it, to use a very sophisticated economic term, is it all going pear-shaped?
I think it is, and that the Tories seem to have taken a strategic decision they've disassociated themselves from the whole Brown strategy, his kind of spending plans, his policy on debt. And as far as I can see, I'm not an economist, I'll defer to those who are, but this is more about politics, not economic. None of us know what debt levels are going to be in the next few years, other than very, 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 very high. Cutting spending is kind of far harder than oppositions claim it is, because whenever they get in the government, there are squeals whenever you try to cut programs. But they seem to take a political decision that this train is heading towards the cliff, and we need to get off before, as you say, it all goes pear shaped next year. What I'm interested in is whether the assumption, and there is an assumption, if things get really, really bad, that's got to be good for the Conservatives and bad for the Labour Party. I'm not sure that's true. There's some polling evidence at the moment that the kind of worse it gets, the better Labour's figures.
Well, Labour does seem to be coming back in the polls, and governments can win elections in recessions. You think of 92.
Yeah. What we don't know is whether they can win recessions in slumps, in because the economists are now saying this isn't going to be a normal common or garden recession. This could get a real sort of epoch-making
that will depend on the time. If you have an election, which does sound absolutely politically mad, but then perhaps the madness of it could be the saving of it. You have one in March, and you have a sort of the beginnings of recession, and so you have the kind of which Cameron's actually started to use this week, hasn't he? He started to say, right, come on, then you decide. Let's have an election as soon as possible, and you decide. Or you have one in the absolute upper limit of when it could be, which is May 2010. And the type of recession and the pain will be just very different. And I don't know whether the possibility of oppositions winning recessions is easier at the beginning of recessions or absolutely at the end.
It's all very scary. I want to hear Ivor the Engine to cheer me up. I'm a bit scared. Tom, can I just ask you about something that Andy said there about how that there really is now a genuine dividing line or dividing lines between the two main parties? That David Cameron has said, I'm opposed to Gordon Brown's fiscal stimulus. This is the injection of £20 billion in the economy to try and kickstart the economy. and I'm going to spend less money than the Labour Party will. I mean, these are real, genuine differences, aren't they?
It's interesting. There are differences, and they're certainly being given a lot of attention, but I'm not sure they're that much bigger than they have been in the recent past. So Gordon Brown is now making a virtue out of borrowing. He was going to have to borrow loads and loads of money before this fiscal stimulus because the government's been running too big an overdraft for too long in the good times as well. So he's decided instead of just like watching debt levels go up to 50, 60 or 70 billion, he'll turn it on his head and make a virtue of it and say, no, we're going to borrow 110 billion and this has got economic benefits as well. Now, David Cameron is accepting that increase to 50, 60, 70 billion. He's just querying about the bit of borrowing on top. So there's not quite the difference on borrowing that people are saying. And the other big choice...
If I was to show my great economic knowledge, that would mean that David Cameron is in favour of the automatic fiscal stabilisers, but not spending beyond that. In other words, the automatic spending, extra spending that kicks in to make up the difference between the drop in tax receipts and the increase on welfare. But not beyond that. Is that essentially what you're saying?
Yes, I am. And I'm saying sort of economically, that's quite arbitrary. You know, it depends how big the unemployment is and how your tax net is organised. How much of the stimulus will be automatic and how much of it will be discretionary. But the really interesting thing that we've seen in the last few weeks is that in the pre-budget report, Gordon Brown and Alistair Darling have committed the Labour government some really big cuts in public spending. He's talking about £5 billion in efficiency savings. That's, you know, that's getting on for 2p in the pound on the basic rate of income tax. That's a lot of money to find by scrimping around the back of the sofa. And yet that's what Gordon Brown and Alistair Darling are saying they can do. And at the same time, the Conservatives are now saying, having previously made a great virtue of we'll match every penny of Labour's spending, they're now saying we're going to spend significantly less. So we've seen both parties move, if you like, to the right and accept there'll be much lower spending.
And they have said that the only two things they'll ring fence in terms of public spending is international development and the NHS, which, I mean, for instance, their schools ideas will require money and they've admitted it will require money. So their programme will change because of this fiscal
position. And it's interesting that the Liberal Democrats, you'd expect on tax and spending to be the most left-wing party, are now the most right-wing party with £20 billion of spending cuts, I think they're talking about. So there we are. Hey, we could set up a party on the left. There'll be lots of space. Andy, can I just ask you that Gordon Brown has sort of been going around saying that his great idea for a fiscal stimulus is supported across the world. Nicolas Sarkozy in France is adopting a plan. Barack Obama will be adopting a plan in the United States when he becomes president in January. But there is one country that's not so keen on this, and this is Germany, Europe's largest economy. Peer Steinbrück, the German finance minister, on Wednesday night described Gordon Brown's cut in VAT as crass Keynesianism. Tell us about that. What's going on?
Well, this was fantastic because as a European finance minister, he remembers 10 years of having Gordon Brown turn up to European summits and lecturing everyone in Europe about prudence and his golden rules and stability and the need to avoid debt financing. And he has come out today and said, well, actually, hang on, it's a bit rich for this guy now to come round and, as Tom says, make a virtue of the fact that he's letting the deficit it balloon. He's also, what's particularly damaging about his remarks is he hasn't just made the general point. He's focused in on the VAT cut, which was the key tax cut in the budget, 12 billion, a huge, I don't think I've ever covered a 12 billion tax cuts before. And he said, well, frankly, this isn't going to make any difference, which backs up what retailers are saying at the moment. And they're slashing prices by 20%, 30%, 40%. You go to Woolies and you can practically pick up things for free at the moment because they've got a closing down sale. So the idea that this 2.5% VAT cut is somehow going to stimulate spending seems frankly balmy. And this is what the Conservatives have been saying. Whenever they've said this, Gordon Brown's been able to say, well, look, hang on, you're on your own. Everyone else agrees with me, which is why I think at some level he probably does think he has saved the world, or if he hasn't saved the world, he's certainly shown leadership. Now, suddenly the Tories, sort of not normally in the past great friends of the Germans or European socialists, SPD
meant to be the sister
minister.
Party of the Labour Party, indeed. Yeah.
And there's a reason why any German of any political hue is against Barroso's fiscal stimuli plan, and that's because a quarter of it would be paid by Germans. Can't you say that?
Well, it's €200 billion plan, but it's up to individual member states if they want to join it.
Merkel said she foresees that they would end up paying a quarter of it.
But the criticism of Germany, isn't it, is that they are obviously the world's largest exporter. It's quite nice for them if everyone does fiscal stimulus plans, because they just sit there and say, "Oh, excellent! Everyone's buying lots of things.
Sell you some more.
Oh, that'll do us nicely." But Tom, let me just ask you for Gordon Brown. Finally, he's sort of saving the world at lunchtime, and then he's mocked by the Germans at dinner time. Is that pretty humiliating, or is this just the cut and thrust of politics?
I don't know. I thought this was quite a striking and unusual thing to have all the niceties that normally go with diplomatic relations, not getting involved in other people's elections, not having a view on what the policies of the French or the German government are. You know, we're used to ministers being very, very cagey when they give these kind of answers. And for this guy to lash out in this way is quite extraordinary. And I suspect it's to do with maybe the German government feels it's under some pressure to launch a stimulus itself. And it's fighting off demands which are being pitched in terms of Gordon Brown's doing it, he's saved the world, everyone else is doing it. Because that might be how it is in Germany, I don't know.
And the British government are saying essentially they've got caught up in a crossfire of a coalition fight between the SPD and the CDU. But they would say that, wouldn't they?
It did read like a great email that you weren't supposed to see.
Exactly right.
This is how all politicians normally talk. They just never say it in public.
I want to know if they're sitting next to each other at dinner tonight. That's going to be the kick. That'll be you're quite off to the summit, aren't you?
Yes. Hello, Pip.
Don't understand what you're saying. Right, well, look, thank you for that. Let us move on.
What's your judgment as to what ought to be done now? You know, there's various discussions about whether should be a report made.
Yes, that was the late Richard Nixon discussing the Watergate affair with aides on the famous tapes concealed in the White House. We thought we'd have a blast of the old rogue after the governor of Illinois was recorded saying that he would like to sell Barack Obama's vacant Senate seat. Rod Blagojevich has the sole power to nominate a successor for Obama after he stood down midterm. Andy, let me ask you, should we laugh or cry at this affair?
Oh, this is fantastic. I'm having read all sorts of stories about US Tammany Hall politics to actually sort of read it in real time and realise it still goes on. And the quotes were wonderful. I don't know if you do Effing and Blinding on your programme.
I think we can have that. Let's have that, yes.
But and he was outraged at the prospect that he should give this away. He said, "You don't fucking give it away." He's charging a million. But then I sort of thought, well, actually, you know, what happens over here? We've had sort of cash for honours. He was asking £1 million for a seat in the Senate, the upper house in the US legislature, of course.
It got to $5 million at one point, didn't it?
Did it?
So there's a lot of money.
A lot of more than a going rate for a seat in the House of Lords, which seems to be about sort of quarter of a million, half a million
so
in terms of donations.
And you get a title with the House of Lords,
K-R-P.
Sort of better.
Yeah, you don't really get very much power, but you do get a title, which seems to be what attracts so many people. Although, yeah, of course, we know there was an investigation. No one is directly selling seats.
No, of course, no, absolutely.
My learned friends, but even Lord Levy, who actually wrote a book about his experience, conceded in his book that there is a correlation between sort of donations to political parties and getting your seat in the Lords, and it always has been sort of right back from the days of Lloyd George. So I mean, it was quite interesting to see how they do it. Do it over there, sort of in Illinois.
They do
Chicago,
it in style, which, don't they?
FBI said, sort of, yeah. If this isn't the most corrupt state in the US, I don't know what is. But it's not wholly dissimilar.
Tom, let me just ask you. I mean, does this show that when they do corruption in the US, they really do it properly? I mean, they really go for it, don't they? We're pretty timid compared with them, aren't they?
I think it's worth singling out the state of Illinois as well, which this great clean man Barack Obama's grown up from, but. The last great progressive president, JFK, was elected in 1960 after Mayor Daley of Chicago, Illinois, voted the graveyards. And that's what made the difference between him winning in 1960 and Richard Nixon winning. So, I mean, machine politics, corruption, that really is the hallmark of Illinois politics. And it has been for a very long time. And it certainly makes British cash for honours and everything else look pretty timid.
Allegra, what are your thoughts?
My arms are folded in disgust at Andy's comments. Because, I mean, with most of the people that got their KLP in the Cash for Honours, they had been involved in some kind of public service. And it is extremely difficult to disentangle.
Oh, in some
whereas this guy is Jesse Jackson, the guy who was trying to buy it. He was Jesse Jackson's son. Now, we don't know the extent.
Well, allegedly, he denies it and said to be number five.
We just don't know whether he's completely followed in his dad's footsteps or not. Yeah. But I think it's an American story, and I don't think people will read it and think, oh, they're all the same.
Ah, there we are. Okay, so that's the sort of the snotty British view. But so what Michael Levy, I suppose, did make a major contribution to public life before he became a lord. He was Tony Blair's tennis partner.
Well, he was his Middle East envoy.
Well, he was already a peer by then.
Oh, okay.
No, let's be fair to Michael Levy. He does run lots of charities and is a very good thing. So that's jolly good that he's a member of the House of Lords.
Concede to Allegra, if you get a seat in the House of Lords, you don't actually wield very much power. I haven't seen any evidence that sort of people have been able to sort of use money to buy political office where they can sort of pull the machineries of influence and power. Sort of people like sitting in the House of Lords because we've got this sort of mad class system in this country, and people are hang up on titles, and you can get to put sort of Lord Sparrow or Lord Watt or whatever on your credit card, and it impresses people in restaurants. And people always say, well, you know, my wife likes it too because she can be sort of lady whoever. If you talk to people from both parties who know how the system works, they will concede that's the challenge. There used to be about 700 peers in the House of Lords. It's come down now. So you don't have to attend very much. There aren't many sort of government ministers chosen from the House of Lords.
Apart from Lord Mandelson.
So people aren't getting sort of executive power this way. They're getting a title and the chance to dress up in city outfit on the state opening of Parliament and all that, which is
but
probably
fine. But to
concede
your point in return, there were some of those that sort of cache of lords who were, for instance, you become particularly involved in the City Academy programme or whatever, and I can see how if you're an opponent of that programme, you just think, well, money bought that programme. That is why we now have this system of, for instance, education, because there were a whole load of people who were willing to give money that would then also perpetuate particular
well, money
way of
paid
schooling.
Money didn't legislate for it. Money didn't interest. It's that programme came about because Tony Blair believed it. Didn't come about because someone said, I want you to create, but if you're a US senator, you really do sort of pull the levers if you get a seat on one of these committees, then there's no end of sort of pork money that you can start channeling wherever you want.
Man.
So it is certainly in a different league, these allegations from anything we have over here. But the point I was trying to make is the correlation between financing and rewards is something we know. And this guy, this Illinois governor, the reason he needed
He's
the money...
He's not pronouncing his name, is he? we need to go to Tom to pronounce the name. Tom, and the name is...
Blagojevich.
That's very impressive.
That
sorry,
written on a piece
you may
of paper,
continue.
By the way.
You may continue your sentence.
He's an American Albanian. I read today.
Illinois
which,
governor
explains
yes.
it. But he was trying to get the cash in before Christmas because the Illinois legislature have introduced campaign finance reform. So from January, he can't get any more money. That's why he kind of needed the cash is checked before Christmas.
So that's what Gordon Brown would call presumably a Christmas fiscal stimulus. Right, well, look, thank you for that. We're now in these difficult economic times going to hear something to soothe us. Yes, that was the clangers dreamt up by the great Oliver Postgate, who died this week at the age of 83. For those of us of advanced years, that takes us straight back to our childhood. Although Postgate was better known in recent years as a political blogger, which was no great surprise to his family because he was the grandson of George Lansbury, the Labour leader from 1932 to 1935. Andy, you're ancient like me. You must remember the clangers and Ivor the engine and all that sort of stuff.
I like the clang. The clangers were, for anyone who doesn't know, they were basically wombles on the moon. They were sort of strange, yeah, elephant-like creatures that sort of wandered around, went in and out of holes and made those funny sounds. I did like them. I'm not quite sure why. There's something quite sort of soothing about them.
And yes, the strange suit.
The soup dragon
gave the same strange soup.
Read, I think Mark Lawson today was suggesting that there's some great political parable in all, because the soup dragon was dispensing sort of welfare to all and anyone who lived on.
That they were public spirited citizens, weren't they?
They were nice. They didn't fight. Nice. They didn't
know. Like
yeah,
just like the wombles.
Picking up litter.
Well, and that wasn't just the clangers. It was also the greatest creation was Ivor the engine.
Hello. The signal was against them. Oh, here's a how do you do. Owen's not awake yet. Give him a blow, Ivor.
All those noises done by Oliver Postgate. Now, Allegra, you're laughing, but you're too young to remember
so
all this.
I'm so sorry for you, because, I mean, that is lame. This for me is kind of, sounds like 100 years ago. But you see, when I was little, we didn't really have a telly.
Oh, you didn't have a telly, but even if you had a telly,
yeah,
presumably
no, it wouldn't
you
have been Bagpuss, because it was things like Fraggle Rock.
Tom,
this is fresher. Well, Bagpuss anyway, which to my mind is the greatest of the greats of the Postgate oeuvre, and
which was later started in 74, I think. Yeah.
74, yeah. Yeah. Although it's much more recent in my memory, seeing as on Monday I had to go and hide in one of my colleagues' office and watch a couple of videos of it in order to write a Guardian editorial about Bagpuss. The thing that struck me was this gloriously slow kind of pace, almost like a kind of really old French film, you know. And I think probably there's enough quirkiness and enough weirdness in Bagpuss to kind of lure children in still, even if they were watching it now on DVD or video. But I do sort of worry that we've lost the ability to watch things that move at that kind of that pace, and it was quite hard to keep awake actually watching it.
That's it from this week's edition of Politics Weekly. Thanks to all my guests, the Guardian leader writer Tom Clark, the Guardian senior political correspondent Andy Sparrow, and Barack Obama's top British Tom Allegra Stratton. I like to get that in because Allegra refers to the president-elect as Barack. Politics Weekly was produced by Francesca Panetta. I'm Nick Watt. Join us again in the new year. Till then, goodbye.